into, you know, briefly?
Well, first of all, in a world of text messages and iPods and apps and various other mediocrities, this was a man of the written word. He was a literate man who dealt with history, Shakespeare, the classics, Greek tragedy. So you could read Jim Murray and you could just read his sports columns and you would be an educated person just by reading it and pursuing the threads that he led you on. Secondly, I believe his greatest contribution was in helping to create or end segregation in collegiate sports. And this being another thing that today's young generation cannot grasp, that there was a time in which there was segregation in America, and it was as recent as the late 1960s, and it was Murray's columns that essentially forced the University of Alabama to consider this stance, scheduled an integrated game with USC, and let this be the pathway to integrating their program. And now we see the greatest program in the nation, the Alabama Crimson Tide. Obviously, this was a great move for them and for all of the South and for America.
Tell me how other sports writers viewed Jim Murray, and because I think that says something.
I think they viewed him with awe, and I think they felt that they wanted to write like him, but few, if any, ever dared to try. Believe it or not, our local guy, Scott Osler, was the closest guy. His current work with the Chronicle is not of that genre, but I was going to USC in the early 1980s and reading Osler in the Times when he was just coming up with that paper. And I noticed then, hey, this is the next Jim Murray. And so when I talked to him, I said, hey, you know, you really had that voice. And he says, yes, I did. But when I moved to the San Francisco Chronicle, I consciously decided to change that style and not really follow that path and write in my own style. Mm-hmm. But he was pulling it off, but few can. And some have tried, and you don't get away with it.
Well, listen, Steve, one of two things. And, you know, the nice thing about the show, we don't rehearse anything. It's very impromptu. Is there something, I have something from Jim Murray to give kind of a context of the type of style he has. Either I could read it, or is there something in your book that you have that you want to promote and then talk about?
Do you have this column there from Halberstam's and Stout's book?
I actually have it, a weird site for a fight.
Is that the Manila fight, the
it's
thriller?
It's the Zaire, yeah. I can read it, or you can read it, or whatever you want.
You can read a little bit of it.
Okay.
I don't have that in my book.
Okay,
I don't have the whole thing read in my book.
So, En Route to Darkest Africa, this is by Jim Murray from the Los Angeles Times, and it says, all right, my good man, hand me my jodhpurs and pith helmet to polish my monocle. Get the elephant ready. Fire up the Queen Africa. Phone Berlitz, and see what they have in the way of Swahili. Get Tarzan and Jane on a drum and see what they're doing. Tuesday, see what you can and find out about the testy fly. Call me Bawana. Let's hope Grace Kelly and Ava Gardner get to fight over me in a steamy jungle night. And then it says, they're holding the World Heavyweight Championship fight in the Congo, I guess because the top of Mount Everest was busy. I don't know why they can't hold it in Yankee Stadium like everybody else. The only African word I know is cheetah. I always thought Kanisha was one of the Gabor sisters. Zaire sounds like a NFL place kicker. So I think that kind of really witty style, yet, go ahead, Steve.
Well, see, to a lot of people, that just sounds like strange stuff. But here's where you have to know what he's just read. He's referenced the movie Mogambo. He's referenced Stanley Livingston and 19th century colonialism in Africa. He's referenced medical discoveries that came out of that period of time. He's referenced movie actors of the 1950s.
Zsa Zsa Gabor, Grace Kelly,
and Ava Gardner. This is the Ava Gardner scene is of Ava Gardner on a Hemingway movie, in which she left that scene and drove and flew back to the United States to get Frank Sinatra the job in From Here to Eternity. All this is referenced in there without telling you. He's expecting you, the reader, to be smart enough to figure it out. So what he's not doing, he's not writing down to you.
So as we talk about Jim Murray, the famous writer from the Los Angeles Times, when we talk to like Patrick here and some of his colleagues, students, why is remembering a man like Murray so important for our younger generation?
Well, for the same reason that you remember Abraham Lincoln or Dwight Eisenhower.
Sure, no.
The great ones need to be memorialized and identified as being above and beyond the rest.
Why is he so relevant today, I guess, is what I want to, is maybe a better question.
Well, because integrity, honesty, and talent are always relevant.
Sure.
And because he shapes the 20th century sports field that takes it from just recreation to big business and a reflection of the United States of America. Sports in the 20th century reflects what I call the new Rome, a new empire with a new leisure class. Never in the history of mankind have average people been able to afford so much leisure activity. This is a product of capitalism in America that throughout the travail of ages never existed. Along comes America, and now it does exist. And it happens in the 20th century. So you have these sports palaces that are built, and you have this incredible love of sports. In the previous times, people they didn't have these pursuits. These were the pursuits only of the upper class. Now the average American citizen can go to the polo grounds, Yankee Stadium, Dodger Stadium.
All right, listen.
You got it.
You know, and true. Pat, did you have something, Chris?
No, I just want to say that, you know, like anybody, when you have contemporaries, you're always talking about these people are all lumped into one group, and then you have somebody like Jim Murray. I mean, you can say that about sportscasters, about baseball players.
Sure.
Anything. And that's one of the reasons, I think, that we need to relate to people like Jim Murray, because they're not of the norm.
No.
They're different.
No.
Yeah. So, Stephen, Jim Murray, you mentioned he's a great. So, what influence has he had on you, maybe as a writer, baseball player?
Good question.
He played a large role in my love of history. And as a writer, writing about sports, realizing it's not just about hits, runs, and errors, but rather. See, Murray, in 1960, Murray was reading a Time magazine report of the Rome Olympics. And the report was Rafer Johnson's times and the Russian Kuznetsov's performance in the decathlon and the boxer then known as Cassius Clay and how he was doing. And Murray was reading this and thinking to himself, well, I know all about Rafer Johnson. He ran at UCLA, and I know their times, and I know that Clay is a good boxer, and this, that, and the other. I want to know what it's like to be in Rome. I want to feel like I'm there. I want to, you know, taste the spaghetti, so to speak. And so he endeavored that he would write beyond the press box, or what he called the myopia of the press box, and beyond describing the cities that he was in, the cultures that he was involved in, and he particularly enjoyed doing that on an international scope. So I tried to do the same thing, and that was probably the big, in answer to your question, probably the biggest influence that he had with me.
And by the way, you are listening to American Political Studies here on NPR. I'm with our guest, Stephen Travers, today. Stephen, you know, we're so glad that NPR could bring such wonderful... No, I'm kidding. Hey, listen, Steve, besides Murray, there's a whole host of other books that you've written. One of them I am very relevant to the Bay Area. I guess we'll start off with this book, and then I want to talk about a very famous book that has gotten a lot of play in the college football world regarding the University of Southern California and Alabama. But one book, Steve and I kind of rekindled our friendship when I was the sports director at KFDY Television. Steve came up and showed us this book. It's called Barry Bonds, Baseball Superman, forward by Charlie Sheen, a man in the news. What's a Sheenism? Awesome? No. What
winning Tiger's winning, blood?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Winning. Adonis DNA, baby. So tell us about the Barry Bonds book, because obviously everybody in the Bay Area and around here, the world, and our Armed Forces Radio that is listening, they know about Bonds. What about Bonds today? What about your book and then Bonds today? It's rather difficult to talk about this man.
Yeah, well, when I was writing it, I got a phone call from Skip Bayless, who's now, I guess he's at ESPN now, but he was with the San Jose Mercury News at the time, and he says, "Hey, you know, Bonds is juiced up. You got to get into it. If you're going to write a book about him, you got to, you know, get into it." And I was on deadline, and you know, I didn't know how to do it. I figured he probably was, but I had no way of proving it. I mean, I would have had to find out about Balco, and then I would have had to go to Balco, and I would have had to sort of stake the place out, which is what Jeff Nowitzki, the FBI agent, was able to do. But he was able to get, you know, he was an FBI agent on stakeout, and it took him years to do it. So my book was written, you know, 2001, 2002, and this all came out beginning in 2003 to 2005. So I wasn't able to uncover his steroid use. But
now, listen, with that said, you know, from my point of view, whether you think agree with this or not, you could have uncovered that type of behavior that he was engaging in. Because a guy from Redwood High School, a fellow Redwood High, Lance, what's his last name?
You're talking about Mark Fanarawada, but the only way he was able to get it was because he was assigned by the Chronicle to a court case that was being held in San Francisco. So he just went, all he did was sit there and write down what the lawyers call discovery. He didn't actually... the real investigation was done by Nowitzki of the FBI.
Okay.
And that was originally uncovered, believe it or not, by another Redwood High School. I think his name was Hershon. No one knows this. A guy by the name of Hershon wrote an article about it in Playboy magazine around 2003 or 2004. Huh. And this spurred all the other activity. So if I'd gotten to Nowitzki before and gotten his full investigation, then I could have done something.
Because Barry Bonds Baseball Superman, written by Stephen Travers and forwarded by Charlie Sheen, that book was really kind of how would you describe this book? I mean, it definitely told about his wonderful, you know, his record season but tell the folks a little about the meat of the book.
Well, that was more of a diary of the 2001 season, because I was a columnist for the San Francisco Examiner, so I was on hand during that whole season and saw Bonds have this record-breaking season. So I saw it firsthand and wrote it from the standpoint of someone who saw history, and then interspersed the chapters with what I could uncover about his life, growing up in the Bay Area, the son of Bobby Bonds and Sarah High School. I also was lucky enough that another fellow Marin County fellow, Charles Scott, had been Bonds' roommate at Arizona State. He gave me a lot of good information.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, hold that thought, because we want to talk about that Charles Scott connection and the Marin County connection.
He's a Penguin basketball player, by the way.
Yeah, he played here at Dominican, by the way, Charles Scott. And he also played in Major League Baseball, played with the Cleveland Indians organization, I believe. Triple A ball. Yeah, no, I understand that. But I'll tell you what, it is 6:31 here on the McDude Show. You are listening to radio.dominican.edu. We're going to take a quick cut time out. Our special guest is Stephen Travers. Do not go away.
I'm Elena. I have a master's degree in giving hope to children in Ethiopia.
I'm John. My farm experience helped villagers in the Philippines feed themselves.
I'm Nanaya. I have a degree in making an impact for generations to come.
If you have a degree in agriculture, the environment, or teaching English, you actually have a degree in doing more than you ever thought possible. Peace Corps volunteers can truly make a difference in the lives of people all over the world. With your skills and education, you could help create an irrigation system for a small village in Paraguay, or share new teaching methods to educators in Moldova. The experiences you'll gain in the Peace Corps will stay with you forever. This is your chance to make a real difference, a difference only you can make. Explore how the Peace Corps can fit into your future. Visit peacecorps.gov.
My resume
now includes changing lives.
We are back. Do we have any music? Come on, man. Do we have anything?
No.
Well, I want to hear some music.
You moving some on up to the east side.
Oh, there's
Steve. We finally got a piece of the pie. Yeah, moving on up.
All right.
Hey, Wheezy.
I love it. Got to have some tunes as we get back into the second hour of the world-famous McDude Show. Curtis Kim and Patrick Yab Yab. Mike McDowd, along with our very special guest, Stephen Travers, author of multiple books, documentaries. Steve, we'll have you throughout the show.
We should have Steve do it. An impression, because he has impression.
I want to hear one.
I was actually thinking of buying the studio.
You were? you probably could.
You want to hear an impression?
I could.
I want to hear an impression.
What do you got, Steve?
Oh, well.
Nicholson or what? What are you going
to
do?
You want to investigate me? Go ahead. Roll the dice and take your chances. I eat my breakfast 300 yards from 5,000 Cubans who were trained to kill me, so don't think for 1 second you could come down here, flash a badge, and make me nervous.
Yes! Yeah. Excellent. Outstanding. In case you folks don't know what movie that was, from a... go ahead, Curtis.
A Few Good Men.
Yeah, A Few Good Men. Tom Cruise.
Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson and Demi Moore.
Yeah.
Also, the comedian Kevin Pollak was in it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But
I have absolutely no responsibilities here whatsoever.
Right.
There's a giant, and if you go to some Giants game, you got Trey, he's a pitcher, but he knew that scene in the courtroom for that movie, Few Good Men, Clay Hensley.
He knew
that scene in the courtroom line for line, and they recorded him, and they did a feature on that. So that's amazing.
That scene gets replayed all the time at boot camps, West Point, Quantico, Marine camps. It's a well-known scene that fires up troops.
Right.
The Patton scene from the beginning of Patton, and a few other scenes from movies.
Stephen Travers, the author of his new book, The Poet, A Story About Jim Murray, a legendary writer for the Los Angeles Times back in the... Well, when did Murray start, actually, Steve? What years?
Well, he was with the Times from 1961 to 1998. Previously, he wrote in Los Angeles, first for the L.A. It wasn't the Herald Examiner, but it was the paper that preceded them. The Mirror or whatever they were, and then Time Magazine throughout the late 40s and throughout the 50s, and then finally hired by the LA Times in 61.
But a myriad of other books, including Barry Bonds' Baseball Superman, came out in 2001, and quickly back to Bonds. Bonds is, I guess, by all accounts, an interesting guy. I guess one time his best friend, Charles Scotta, who played at Terrell High School and played at Arizona State with Bonds, I'm told that, I'm told many things, some things I can say on the air, some things I cannot say on the air, but give us a little, I mean, there were times when Charles would walk into the locker room, and Charles played basketball here at Dominican, I believe in the 90s, and in fact, we'll have him on the air sometime, but he'd walk in and he'd say, "Hey, Barry, how you doing? You know, best of friends." And then the next time he'd walk in, Bonds would act like he'd never even seen the guy in his life.
That was Charles told you that?
Yeah.
He didn't tell me that, but that's exactly my experience. One day you'd walk into the locker room, dressing room, and Bonds would be all over you, glad-handing. "Hey, come on over here. Check this out. Hey, what do you think?" The next day, you're Patrick Swayze and Ghost, you know.
Yeah, right.
He can't
right.
see you.
Right.
So, I realized that was just who he is. It wasn't personal. But I think a lot of writers took it personally because they don't like that. They want to be acknowledged. And, you know, by the time Bonds' career came along, you have this discrepancy in income between riders
who are
making, you know, whatever they're making and the multi-million dollar records of Bonds and players like that. And I think you have some a certain amount of resentment that people in the media, except for the very top of the media, like a Jim Rome, people have for these athletes.
Yeah, well, I heard when he was with Pittsburgh, everybody, all the sports writers kind of knew he was kind of standoffish, to say delicately. When he came to the Giants, a lot of writers didn't, you know, weren't aware of that. And I guess they found out real quick that Barry was not the most cordial guy to interview or talk to in the locker room or whatever.
Right. You know, and I think when I got there, I had been in Los Angeles for many years, and I just showed, first of all, I introduced myself and said, I'm friends with Charles Scott. That was, great, really. Yeah, how's Charles doing? Yeah. So that helped. And then I had no baggage with him. So I immediately actually developed a certain rapport with him that no other writer there had. And it was a very strange situation because a lot of established writers, like guys like Ray Ratto and Bruce McGowan, and people were looking, who is this guy? All of a sudden, Bonds knows this guy. They wanted, did I know him, or did I grow up with him or something, which I hadn't. So I was able to establish a rapport with him, and that really was how I developed enough of a relationship to get the idea of a book with him, and that eventually became the book that you're holding.
Yeah, and a successful book, but one of many out there, isn't there? I mean,
I was the first one, first book.
Yeah. And really, in my opinion, the best of the Bonds books. You know.
Thank you. Appreciate
you're welcome.
That.
You're welcome.
Oh, we played a little feature of you earlier in the first hour when we were promoting you. The feature I did with you regarding the Oakland Raiders and the book you wrote about them, The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, and the Oakland Raiders.
Well, as I understand, that earned you an Emmy award.
An Emmy.
Still waiting for my bonus on that
though.
One.
You told the story about Phil Villapiano and the motorcycle guys that they got in the fight with in some bar in Santa Rosa.
Oh, yeah. Well, my favorite was Hunter S. Thompson and Al Davis, Hunter S. Thompson, the famous Gonzo rider, finds Al Davis on the practice field, and Davis has a fit. How did this guy even get here? You know, and he, you know, he's a very strange and odd-looking character, and he was then banned from the field. So, Thompson heretofore interviews each of the Raiders in various Oakland dive bars. So all of his interviews with Villapiano and Ken Stabler and Atkinson and all these guys are taking place. And let's remember, this is Oakland in the early 70s. These are Hell's Angels bars.
Yeah.
And Thompson already knew the territory because he'd written a book about the Hell's Angels. So it was a great story that he did.
Yeah. And Thompson was very prolific in the drug world. So to speak, so to say.
Yes, he was.
did he indicate that he had a little bit of partying experience with any of the Raiders at all? Or
I believe so. I believe there might have been a little ganja smoke at some point.
So the Barry Bonds book, that was one of your first books, correct? When you found out it was nominated for a Casey Award, like what was going through your mind?
I thought that was great. My publisher informed me that it was nominated for Best Baseball Book of the Year. And there were some good books written that year. And I was very honored that it was given some consideration. You know, it was a timely story. It was about that he was the biggest name in sports at the time, and he had just broken the greatest record. So I knew when I started writing that, hey, this is a very timely story. This is going to sell, and this is going to be of interest.
Which was the home run record, right? The
home run record. Right. This was the 73 home runs that he hits in 2001 to break the 70 homers by Mark McGwire in 1998.
Quick question regarding that home run record. In your opinion, in the steroid era, is that a legitimate record? I mean, I don't believe it is. I think Henry Aaron is still the guy.
I think Bonds might have broken Roger Maris's record of 61 homers legitimately. But let's remember, Bonds had come into the league in 1986. So this is between 1986 and 2001. He'd never hit more than 49 homers in his prime years. Mm-hmm. Now, all of a sudden, boom, he hit 73 homers. Mm-hmm. So that tells me if 49 is his ultimate, and, you know, now you're adding, I'm not a math major, 10, you know, 24 extra home runs. Maybe he had, now maybe he could have added 10 home runs legitimately, you know, gotten to 59, 60, challenged the record. I don't know. I don't think he hit 73 normally. I don't think anybody does.
No. Yeah. Well, I remember, who's the Brady for the, was it Brady, the catcher for the Baltimore Orioles, had that breakout year. Following year, he gets busted for steroids. I mean, you know,
well over 50 homers.
Right. So listen, let's move on. 43 after the hour, here on the world famous McDude Show. Following up to a few other yearbooks, or do you want to hit your article and then we'll talk about the Bama?
Yeah, well, I have an article in Gentry magazine that's out right now, and there are two articles in there, one on Tim Lincecum, and the other is the Giants ownership group with an exclusive interview I did with Larry Baer, and I think it's pretty timely for San Francisco audiences.
Okay, and let's hit Lincecum first. What did you find out? Anything new or anything insightful?
Well, I think I approached it from the standpoint that for the first 3 or 4 years of his career, we're talking about a young man who's considered the very best in baseball. And then I compared his career with Tom Seaver. And we see that Seaver never had a down year like Lincecum had. Mm. And most pitchers have had down years. And so what this tells me is that Seaver is one of such a rare breed of maybe 10 or 15 pitchers in all of baseball history have had a career like that. Everyone else has a year like Lincecum. They all have a down year. So I guess the bottom line on that is we know Lincecum's human.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to get to the SC Bama thing before we run out of time.
And can you give us 15 seconds on Larry Baer? Anything?
That's a very, very unique ownership group, a very egalitarian group in which no single character dominates. They do it in a very different way, and it's completely separate from previous ownership groups in the Bay Area that have always been dominated by a single individual, whether it's Finley with the A's, DeBartolo, Muley. Previous owners have always stamped their name and their personality. This is a community group, and it's worked for them.
Who was the guy that Bill Newcomb, right?
Yeah, he looked like Kennesaw Mountain.
Yeah, right. He wore the bow tie. Yeah. I heard some privy information that the Giants were kind of fed up with him. I mean, I don't know.
Something happened.
Something big happened there.
He's gone.
Something big happened there. And, you know, we don't know the gist of it. But anyways, let's move on. Very famous 1970s, the integration of football in the southern part of the United States. And your alma mater, the University of Southern California, had a significant part in that history.
Well, this is a game between all-white Alabama and integrated USC, 1970. Mm-hmm. And the game was set up by the coaches, Bear Bryant and John McKay, as a demonstration for the fans to get them ready for what Bryant was planning, which was to integrate his program as smoothly as possible. The game is played. USC wins by a large margin, and as fate would have it, their African-American players are the stars of the game. And essentially, the fandom of Alabama afterward is now does not need to be coerced or dragged into wanting black players. They have now subversively and smoothly had a demonstration that now makes them want black players. And that's the only way to do it. You can't force people through riots and protests and speeches. You got to get into their hearts and minds. And so the great Jim Murray the next day, this is what he writes. He writes, "They ratified the Constitution, signed the Bill of Rights. They have struck the stars and bards. They now hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal in the eyes of the Creator. And then he goes on to describe the game in these flowery terms, and I think he met the occasion by basically welcoming Alabama into the mainstream of American politics with this victory. And we look at the South since then, all they've done is rise, while the rest of the country is mired in whatever they are.
Didn't you say it was a game that changed history? How did you phrase that when you talk about that game?
Well, it absolutely opened the floodgate of African Americans into Southern sports teams. Yeah. And sports is so integral to the South that when that happened, it just opened the rest of society. And 8 years later, the two teams played. Now they're both equally integrated. It's not even an issue. Eight years later, it happened so seamlessly and quickly that it wasn't even something anyone noticed. 8 years later,
I know HBO Films. They had a documentary of that, and Coach Bear Bryant after the game said to John McKay, "Thank you," because they got blown out, and that's just saying that word "thank you" after being blown out. Probably just made Alabama more integrated after everyone in Alabama didn't want any black players at all. So,
right. Well, what my book is about is how McKay and Bryant were good friends and unlikely progressives of civil rights. These are two good old boys from the South. These are not, if you were going to predict who is going to lead the way in civil rights progressivism of the late 60s, these are not the two guys you'd predict. And yet, they probably do more with this game by creating this game. And this game is out of an eight-year friendship and a long decision. When are we going to play? When are we going to be able to do this? And the opportunity presented itself that year, and Bryant immediately scheduled the game, and it had that effect. And that's exactly what happened. At the 50-yard line, Bryant said, "Hey, thank you, John, for bringing your team down here and for playing this game with us."
And I think one of the things that I'm aware of, but I'd like you to explain to our viewers, one of the more profound things that happened at that game was with the African-American fans who were typically rooting for Alabama, but guess what? They've now found a new team in Southern Cal in terms of rooting for them. Tell us that story. It's really very...
Well, I mean, this is a game that evokes biblical imagination, like Moses crossing the Red Sea. The game ends, and you have... It's on radio. It's not on television. It's a night game. Mm-hmm. The game ends, and there's a lot of black people who live in Birmingham, Alabama, and that stadium is in the black part of town. Mm-hmm. The game ends as the USC team is heading to the bus. They find themselves surrounded by African Americans holding Bibles and candles and singing hymnals.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
This is something out of Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. This is Martin Luther King's dream 2 years after his assassination. This is the culmination of everything that he and Jackie Robinson and other civil rights leaders have wanted to do and struggled to get to this mountaintop. And here it is in such an unlikely place, Legion Field at Birmingham, Alabama. You know, who'd have thought? But this is where it happens. And they are holding these candles, and these USC players are coming out and going, "Holy cow, did we do this? Or this really happened?" And it did.
Now, there was something in the HBO film also that they were worried about people from USC, the black players from USC, just traveling to Alabama. They were worried. The parents were worried. Like, can you explain anything on that?
There were USC players. This is 1970, and this is before. In 1971 at the Marin County Courthouse, Angela Davis smuggled a gun in which George Jackson used to kill Judge Haley and to paralyze District Attorney, I think his name was Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
This began the process of what you know every time you go to an airport and stop, and you have to go through a detector,
a metal detector.
Yeah. There were no metal detectors at airports. Four or five of the USC players were packing guns on that trip and were going to bring them to the field and keep them like under in case something happened. That's how worried they were.
Because they wanted
Because they were worried that a riot could break out, that there could be violence, that their lives could be in danger. This is what's going on. And at the last second, they get talked down. Don't do it. Don't do it. It'll be the biggest disaster ever. And they did not bring the guns. And this story, it was not, nobody knew of this story until my book. But that's, you're absolutely right. They were worried.
Yeah.
And let me tell everybody out there, you are not listening to NPR Sports Radio. This is the world famous McDude Show. Really incredible stuff. Our good friend Steve Travers joined us here on the McDude Show. And Steve, that was just really, you don't get this type of information on the KNBRs and the 95.7s. They just don't do it. So we're really glad you could join us. Tell us where we can get your books, how we can get more of your wonderful work.
Well, the books are easily available at Amazon. Just type in Stephen Travers, and I've got a nice page with all of them listed. I would also recommend you go to my website, which is redroom.com, and then you just find authors and look under, get to the T's and hit Travers, and my site will come up.
Well worth looking up.
And real quickly before we go, we've got two minutes, and I'm counting. I'm using every second. I'd like you to do a promo for us. Hi, I'm Steve Travers. You're listening to the McDude Show. McDude. Go for it. Give us one of your best, one of your McDude promos. Just make something up. But
well, he's McDude. It's McDude. And it's Curtis Kim and the other fellow over here. We're having a good old time, and I advise that you listen to this on a regular basis. And if you don't, I'm going to come out there, and I'm going to give you bodily harm. This is Steve Travers, over and out.
And you're listening to the McDude Show.
You are listening to the McDude, Show.
Hey, quickly, before we go.
Yes.
Minute 12 left in the game between California and UNLV, and the Golden Bears have a five-point lead, 58-53. 1 minute, 12 seconds left. It could go down to the wire.
All right. Patrick, we got about 1 minute here. Quickly, final thoughts of today's show. How are we doing? Do you like where we're going?
I love it. I feel like you two have a good chemistry. I feel like I'm getting this vibe.
You're okay.
You're okay.
And also for sports fans out there, Baltimore Ravens lose their strong safety, Bernard Pollard. He joins the Tennessee Titans today.
Oh, okay. Right. I like it. Curtis, what about it? First show.
I think it was great. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Isn't it a lot of fun? Yeah. Isn't it a lot of fun, Patrick?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Steven, a lot of fun.
Yeah, and Patrick, I'm sorry I forgot your name there. I hadn't forgotten it, but I was pressed at the last second. But I want to congratulate you. You definitely were prepped with some great questions and understood that topic. Even though it happened 20 years before you were born. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. We want to thank our very special guest, Stephen Travers, our executive producer, Patrick Yab-Yab.
There he is.
Hey, you got it right.
And the legend of legends, the Associated Press multi-award winner, my good friend Curtis Kim. I'm Mike McDowd. Thanks for listening to the world-famous McDude Show. Stay tuned for more great radio here on radio.dominican.edu. It's the McDude Show.